Hello, this is Theatre Voice. I'm Dominic Cavendish, and I'm with Harriet Walter in a community centre in Clapham, South London, where rehearsals are underway for the West End transfer of Dinner, a new play by Moira Buffini that was a sell-out success in the Littleton Loft season in 2002. Harriet Walter is reprising the principal role of Paige, an acid-tongued hostess who presides over a vicious and viciously entertaining dinner party. Harriet Walter, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to Theatre Voice today. In your distinguished career, you've done a wide range of parts, it's fair to say. At the classical end of the spectrum, you've taken on roles like Lady Macbeth, Hedda Gabler, Masha and Three Sisters, The Duchess and The Duchess of Malfi, but you've also been very willing to take on new plays. I just wondered, really, as a sort of starting point, whether you make any distinction in your own mind between a role that is, as it were, a classical role and one that's just been freshly penned. Is there a sort of difference immediately, straight off for you?
The main difference is that quite often a contemporary play, you've got to think about, you have to locate the character because everybody's very familiar with the terms of the present tense and what sort of clothes they wear and what sort of person, what sort of type they are. And that sort of preoccupies you a bit, much more than in a classic where you are much more going for the essence of a character and for the language and for the times, plural, you know, and you can be, in a way, more free with, you know, the historical detail and stuff. Certainly with Shakespeare, you don't have to locate someone. Oh, I know she's the sort of person who wears Armani trousers or, you know, whereas with a modern play, you're often rather bugged down with, I don't know these sort of people. I've never met them. How am I going to find them? I'll have to go and follow people in the street. You don't have that problem if you're playing Cleopatra. You just go for the essence.
In this case, I suppose, just to talk about Paige, for example, you've already played this role to acclaim at the National, but what were your first thoughts when you were given this part, when in fact you auditioned for it, I suppose?
Well, I was going to also say that I think I'm predominantly someone who's attracted to the language of a play, and Moira Buffini is what I call a language writer, just as Howard Barker is a language writer, and there are writers who aren't language writers. They're more, you know, they're more visual, or they're, you know, their starting point is not necessarily the language. So in a way, I was offered this script when I was playing Much Ado. I was playing Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing. And that is not, you know, she doesn't have any poetic flights, actually. She's kind of quite prosaic. It's quite a natural, distancing role, Beatrice. She's quite sort of accessible. And so I think what I responded to, because I was in classical mode, if you like, was the language of Moira Buffini. And she writes the thing on the page rather like a poet. And everything is very, you can tell immediately from the presentation of the script that this is a woman who cares exactly where her commas and dots and full stops go, rather like Pinter or someone. She's in that tradition. And this very strong, unique voice came through to me. And that is a real plus. It gets your adrenaline going immediately. And it is a fantastically bizarre play. And, you know, it scores highly on originality. So, you know, you do, when you're leafing through it, go, my God, this is something different, you know. And if it was just being original for original's sake, I think that would have caved in round about page 20. But you just kept being led through that there is substance, this is going somewhere, this is very carefully wrought. And it's just a fabulous sort of, I'd never done anything like it. It's rather a sort of gothic character.
You've written a superb book called Other People's Shoes, which has just been issued in paperback by Nick Hearn Books. And reading that book, one's often struck by how much work actors do in thinking through other possibilities, creating a sort of hinterland for characters, most of which is almost invisible to the naked eye in a way, but obviously reassures the actor that really they found the right note. Can you sometimes run out of those sort of options of thinking, well, how far do I go down the line in terms of fleshing out detail that isn't visible to the spectator?
You have to discipline yourself when things aren't relevant. You know, you can get I think that's one of the traps of the sort of Stanislavski method of sort of creating too much backstory and too much hinterland, which, you know, is an indulgence in a way, because there's only X amount that's going to be effective, visual, readable, understandable, communicable to an audience. So you have to discipline yourself, or the director has to discipline you, to really shave away that which isn't helpful. And so there are avenues that would be frightfully interesting if I wanted to amuse myself with them, but at the same time they're not actually going to help play the part. And usually rehearsals are so short that you've got your work cut out, just learning the lines that are there and thinking the thoughts that are totally relevant. I think it's just a question of, you know, when people ask you, the most frequently asked questions that I think most actors get asked are, how do you learn your lines and how do you not get bored doing it every night? And the answer is the answer to both of them is wrapped up in one answer, which is to do with how much interior work you've got. The interior life of your character helps you to understand what they might want to say next and why they say it. And it also, the more you've bedded in some imaginative world for yourself, the more you don't get bored when you play it every night, because things are slightly different and, you know, you can go for different aspects of your character. You know, tonight I'll go for her greed, or tomorrow I'll go for the fact, you know, she's, you know, her tenderness, or, you know, you sort of give yourself a little aim, and if you've done a nice spread of research inside yourself, you can keep it fresh. The difference to an audience will be minimal, but it's, you know, a lot of this research is in order to feed you for long periods of playing the same thing every night.
One of the dangers is that you can, particularly if you're having to work on something quite fast, is use shorthand, use even stereotype, fall back on that. I don't really know very much about the character Paige, but presumably she could just be a kind of vixen from hell.
I mean, there's an element where you say, yes, full stop, this is vixen from hell, let's embrace it, let's not shirk it, this is part of the design of the play. There are some archetypes, it is an allegory, there is a sort of non-naturalistic dimension to the play, and it's important to embrace that when that is the case, and not try and make every part you play frightfully naturalistically detailed if it's not particularly what matters and or how the play functions. I'm finding that coming back to it after a year, I've got much more depth laid down. Things have happened to me in the year. My mother's died. I've been ill. You know, things have, you know, this is not, I'm not the same person this November as I was last November. So that necessarily goes into it. And I feel, you know, it would be a bit of an advantage to have a year between, you know, to do everything one year on and see what more you find, because rehearsals are of necessity very rushed, particularly with a new play. You're still deciding what line should go where, and the writer's still in there rewriting. So, you know, to have 4 weeks from first read through to first preview is cutting it fine anyway. So you feel, you do grab at the top layer, you do grab at the superficial thing that works, and you hope that over the run you'll find more depth and truth to it. But there's no doubt about it that there's masses more fuel going into it this time, because, you know, one sort of understood much more what's going on at the heart of the woman. The trouble with the part is that I can't demonstrate the heart of the woman, because it's a secret. And those are bloody difficult parts to play, because you've got to keep everyone interested, which Moira gives me bags of great one-liners and things and twists and, you know, unexpected things to keep the audience interested. But so that's the sort of Cruella de Vil level. But the actual depth of the woman is not really revealed until right at the end.
There's a really nice description in the book about going into Peter Jones and shadowing women that you thought resembled Biddy in Three Birds Alighting on a Field. And I just wondered really whether you, as you got older, whether in fact some of that work isn't as necessary as it once was, whether you trust yourself more to get the character, or do you still like to kind of shadow suspects?
I think it's absolutely true that as you get older you distill your working process, and you know I've found that very much. I don't need to go visit all these places that I used to go, you know. I hope they're kind of partly, I can press buttons now rather than dig great trenches. But there's a fear that, you know, am I therefore going to become more facile, and, you know, I don't really want to become, you know, very surfacey because I'm so smug about how I can do it, you know, because I think that would be death. But I do think that it's horses for courses, and what you needed for Timberlake Wurtenbaker's play was, you really needed very, very, what you were asking me earlier, which I didn't really answer, was when you have a sort of perhaps a sort of stereotypical thing, and you need to find some naturalistic mannerisms to kind of flesh it out or adorn it somehow. that is true of certain characters and not of others. And I would say in Timberlake's play, again, she'd written a very strong voice, which I could hear in my head and knew who it was and recognised. But in order to meet her myself, I had to kind of, you know, latch on to real people in the real street. For Paige, I don't feel I need that, although there is an element in me, I have to confess, of she seems to be an amalgamation of lots of things, not just of people, but also of styles and things and flavours, not just people. She's something bigger than a person, and therefore to actually sort of say, oh, I think she's the sort of person, she lives in Esher and she uses this kind of furniture and she went to this kind of school, somehow doesn't help me play what I have to play. Whereas with Biddy in Three Birds, the tics and mannerisms and sort of way she walked and things were very essential to how I was going to tell the story of her. So it varies. I don't have a method, and no doubt I'll follow people in the street again sometime. Mm-hmm. But for this part, I didn't particularly need to do that.
Again, referring to the book, I suppose in its entirety, what it suggests is that you are actually very analytical about the way you perform and the kind of duties that entails. I wasn't sure how much you were keeping diaries all the way through your career, or whether actually a lot of it was just grouping together things that you'd never entirely kind of crystallised before, and whether once you've done that, you don't need to be so analytical anymore. You've now formulated your view of yourself.
Actually, I think there's quite a lot of truth in that. The first show I did after I sort of took quite a few... I took a year off theatre. I did TV and film jobs while I was writing the book, but I didn't do any theatre deliberately, really. The first play I did after that was The Late Middle Classes, which Harold Pinter directed, Simon Gray's play, and I felt awful because the book was just about to be published, and I thought, I'm not doing anything I say I do in the book. I'm just doing it, you know, and I'm being much more simplified, non-analytical about it. And I thought, you know, the phrase "do as I say, not do as I do" came into my head. You know, here I've written all these wisdoms and I'm actually not carrying them out. But I think there was an element of that I'd done a lot of thinking, and that I then trusted that the process would be much more automatic. And the book was written by a combination. There were snippets of diaries, there were snatches of things I'd been asked to write before. There were chapters of other people's books I dipped into, or I reread plays, or looked at my rehearsal notes. But I'm not a methodical sort of diary keeper, or, you know, I was snatching. And also, I was just using things very specifically if they could exemplify something I was talking about. So it didn't have a sort of chronology. It was just sort of, that was when I was going through that phase, and that book we discussed this. I mean, that rehearsal we were doing that, and, you know, so it was kind of pick and mix, really. And I found, yes, there were quite a few things I thought I didn't know. I thought that, how interesting. How do I know what I think till I see what I write, kind of thing. But
do you have a very precise memory of how you played things? I mean, particularly in this case, you talk about the differences that you've noticed and within yourself, if nothing else. But can you recall, once you're in rehearsal, this is how I did it, this is how it went, and click back in that way, or do you almost have to build from scratch again?
It's frustratingly difficult to remember, because, I mean, I've got a great friend who's a painter, and I kind of always want to know, where did you put the first brush stroke? Where did, you know, and you can't actually, I mean, I think it's a very almost impossible process to deconstruct a creative process. I think, you know, your imagination's working and you don't know what it's doing subconsciously. You don't know where ideas come from. All I know is an interesting sort of, I talk about the dynamics of the rehearsal room, the fact that it is a collaborative thing, and that you can't go off on you might want to be exploring this, but the agenda for the day is we're going to do act two, and you're still thinking of act one. So you have to be quite flexible and able to drop what you think you want to do. And all I know is that early on I described rehearsing Ophelia at the Royal Court with Richard Eyre, and it was my first sort of big proper job, in inverted commas, and I was quite intimidated by the setup, and I'd never done Shakespeare before and all that. And I did a lot of my homework at home, didn't bring it into the rehearsal room. I mean, partly it was only a 3-week rehearsal, you can hardly believe it, but it was. And therefore, a lot of the attention was obviously on Hamlet, on Jonathan Pryce, who was doing his work. So I think people were grateful that I did a lot at home. But I did it because I was scared to bring it into the rehearsal room. It was like I had to practice at home first and bring it in, which isn't the ideal way. And I've got braver about bringing my thoughts into the rehearsal room and collaborating more.
Tying in a little bit with your work in the 70s, which seemed to come about a lot through collaborative exercises and also quite a lot of in-depth research, I just wonder whether that had shaped your determination to dig quite deep when you approached any kind of character.
Perhaps it did. Perhaps, I mean, I think there was a time before, you know, there were other generations of actors before my generation where, in a way, the brief was more simple. And they weren't worse for that, I don't think. I think there's just so much drama around now, and the immediacy of television and film and everything, the sort of goalposts for what is truthful have shifted, you know, because you read accounts of acting in the 19th century, and you know, they say people, the thing that the highest praise a critic could write of an 18th century or a 19th century actor is how they were so truthful. They held the mirror up to nature. They were truthful, and yet we know from looking at even old films of Barrymore or someone that it was very heightened to our eye. Or you hear an old record of Irving or something, and it's terribly exaggerated and terribly heightened. But within the framework of people who didn't watch TV and film, and you know, there was a theatrical truth to it which they bought. And if they were a great actor, you know, they could be truthful while they were being so seemingly artificial. But, you know, it's necessary to do all this analytical work to make things not generalised, not sort of... because the audiences see so much acting, they are much more picky now. They're much more alert, and they can see and they know when they don't believe you, and you know, so it's a survival thing. You partly the boredom of playing in a generalized way, you get so bored of yourself after a few days, and partly just, you know, the fact that you know, audiences want to see much more detail. And also, you know, the 70s when I started out was the sort of, if there was a golden age, there was a sort of golden age for political fringe theatre, and the message was as important as the medium, and so we were always very conscious analysing the meaning of what we were doing, which sounds very pretentious now, but you know, it was a sort of a real belief that we could change people's minds through theatre, and therefore if you're aware of your place within that process, you obviously have a lot of discussion and a lot of you know, analysis amongst you, but it all sounds rather boring when I say that, when I throw in that it's nearer to playing around in a playroom than working in an office. So it is analysis, it's breaking things down, but it's trying to find different colours and make it more interesting and varied, really.
Well, it's interesting that one of the directors you worked with when you were back in the 70s was Max Stafford Clarke, and he's just been awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Evening Standard. I suppose it's interesting to know whether, in a sense, that is the legacy of those kind of exploratory years in the 70s when... As people might be surprised to learn that you were really quite radical. I think you went off and you slummed it, and you did difficult and experimental projects. But do you think that is really the foundation stone for much of your generation, or particularly even you, that you wouldn't be the actress you were without all that?
I do think that. I think there are people... there are lots of names in the establishment now, like Max Stafford Clarke, David Hare, David Edgar, you know, who were, and Carol Churchill. They are now, they've absolutely, they're up there. But when I worked with them, they were sort of the radical fringe that people, you know, the mainstream hadn't really taken on board. And there was this movement from the fringe into the national companies, like David Edgar into doing Nicholas Nickleby, David Hare to doing his large-scale plays at the National. And the radical boys became the West End boys in a way, and that's not a bad thing. I don't think they were selling out. I think they changed the nature of the establishments they were working for. But I think, you know, Max Stafford Clarke is very much an actor's director, and wasn't particularly noticed by the establishment, you know, didn't, because he didn't sort of bring great starry, glitzy hits to the West End. He was beavering away in the background, if your point of view is Shaftesbury Avenue, do you know? But I suppose what he established, because if you're concerned with, as I say, this was a sort of Marxist POV, although nobody was actually declaring, you know, it was non-aligned, kind of non-specific lefty. But you basically, I suppose it was in the culture to not indulge the personal and to present the political, and therefore the culture of the fringe was rather against self-indulgent emotional stuff. And you were always, the tension as an actor was, yes, you wanted to get personal, you know, you needed to be personal because you weren't just a stand-up agitprop thing, but you always had the drive forward to be telling the story, to be making the message clear that we, plural, not just I, were telling. And that's very much Max's discipline and Max's framework is always, his system is very much to ensure that there is a forward thrust, an active thrust to the play, that nobody's holding it up to indulge themselves. And I think that's absolutely deserving of a great honour at the end of the year, achievement or whatever he's had, because it's created a culture of acting which has certainly hit drama schools. It's now it's in the vocabulary of drama school acting. You know, it's what people learn in a way that it wasn't when I was younger.
I think people should obviously have to go out and buy the book in order to get a proper resume of your early days. But if you had a quick way of recapturing, if it's possible, your starting point when you started and you left Lander in 1973, and within very swift succession you sort of joined some of the defining touring companies of the 70s, Joints.com, Comstock, 784, Payne's Plough. This was almost your natural milieu, was it really, for a time?
It was surprising. I was always a mixture between I was terribly diffident, that was the word people used. I learned what it meant because people applied it to me. A lot of acting is about confidence, and I just didn't have that kind of, I didn't have what that thing that I would go into an audition and hit people between the eyes. You know, a lot of people just, my talent, such as it was, just went past them. They just didn't notice it. So in a way that was my saving grace, because I didn't get into establishment things. I didn't get offered a TV series. I didn't get an agent. I didn't get whipped up to do a West End play, which some people do as soon as they leave drama school, and then they kind of miss out on a lot. In a way that I was still learning as I left drama school, and I'm sure that's a good place to be, because you certainly don't come out of 3 years or 2.5 years knowing I've got it, you know. Well, see, certainly I didn't. So I was still learning, and actually I just slithered sideways into Common Stock, which had been founded by teachers who'd been at Lambda, where I trained. And so it was very much a continuation of the improvisations, the exploration, the physical theatre that we'd been doing at Lambda. Those were my favourite subjects, and the teachers who taught them had gone off and founded a company that was a community theatre that was to take up issues that happened, say, on this or that housing estate, build a play with the inhabitants of that housing estate, and take it round other housing estates to see if they related to it. And, you know, that was a fairly radical idea then, but it was a wonderful transition to go from the lack of responsibility of drama school, just endless open-ended exploration, but not having that cut off, so, and then suddenly you've got to be a professional, but being able to still continue those sort of things where you used to spend half the day improvising and half the day building the play, do you know what I mean? So, and then you had to perform it. So it was ideal kind of apprenticeship and transition, and it built my confidence. And then that in itself was a network. You didn't need an agent. There was a guy in that company who knew a guy in that company. And it's hard to explain, but there was a proliferation of these companies that split and became other companies, and, you know, Monstrous Regiment came out of Belt and Braces came out of 784, you know, and they kind of flowered and blossomed and took off into different areas, and everybody sort of knew one another. It was a completely discreet world. And to me, that I had quite a problematic time thinking I was selling out when I eventually kind of crossed the border and went into the Royal Court. You know, the Royal Court was we think of it as radical, but to me it was like, oh my God, I'm going into the establishment, you know. But that was the sort of thinking, that was where my head was at in those days. I don't suppose it relates to people who are young now. But I'm glad I did that route, because I've never lost that kind of sense of why you're doing the theatre, you know, not just to entertain people who are rich enough to buy tickets. You know, there's always been that other dimension to what I want to do.
I suppose the final question is almost really related to the fact that you've got to get back into rehearsals. Whereabouts are you, you know, in rehearsals at the moment? It's week two?
It's the middle of week three, and next week we start performing at some point.
So what does it feel like exactly at this moment in time?
I'm holding my breath, that's what it feels like, because in a way it's changed quite, I mean, over half the cast's different, and bringing in completely new energy, which is great. That's always very stimulating. As I say, my head's in a different place. We've all been through different things in a year. Moira has changed and tightened things up and completely altered the ending. So I haven't got the complacency of knowing, well, I know this works, you know, it worked. A, because it's different, and B, because we were playing in the loft, which holds 100 people, and they felt like they were in the dining room with us, and now we're going to be very much more presentational behind a cross arch at the Wyndham Theatre. So I don't know. I am kind of in that state of, I'm in a hurry to get it on and see how it's going to work. There's kind of anticipatory excitement, but which won't be satisfied until we've got an audience. So there's a bit of me going, I'm longing to get an audience. And there's another one that's really seeing how necessary the work we're doing now is, which is breaking it down into tiny details. And we're at the point where we haven't put it all together again yet. So we're kind of, are we going to be able to speed it up? Because it should run very quickly. It should be quite a speedy evening. You shouldn't really have time as an audience to catch your breath. You know, it should be just lobbing things at you from left, right, and where are we going, you know? And if we sort of indulge any moments, it kind of dips in the middle and people have time to think, you know, because it's not, I don't think she's setting out to sort of say something brand new. I think it's like a deadly reminder more than a new piece of information. And it's the way it's told that's entertaining and fun rather than what she's saying. What she's saying is quite, you know, something we all know, if you know what I mean. Namely, that we're all going to die.
Well, on that somber note, thank you very much, Harriet Walter.